Today is Tuesday, March 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the impact of the Biden administration's policy change at the nation's southern border?
So I worry about those numbers because that leads me to believe that we are going to hit a crisis, especially under COVID-19.
Plus, former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig stood trial in Beijing Monday.
He's been arbitrarily detained, and now we see that the court process itself is not transparent.
And what do we know about COVID-19's effect on the heart? We'll have these stories and more next. Since the suspension of the Trump administration's Migrant Protection Protocol program, also known as the Remain in Mexico policy, thousands of asylum seekers have been able to enter the United States to present their cases. In addition, thousands of others have arrived at the border also hoping to gain entry. Celia Mendoza starts us off.
Jose Raul Estrada Zavala, who lives in a camp in Ciudad Juarez, has been waiting for his turn to go to the U.S.
In my case, I've waited for my process and it'll be what God wants. I'm one of the people who have never tried to cross illegally because I want to be in the United States and I want to have a work permit.
His case and hundreds of others are now being handled differently after the Biden administration revoked the former administration's Remain in Mexico program.
It's an approach that recognizes the need to address root causes of migration in a comprehensive manner over the long term, to also address challenges at our U.S. southern border, including changes to how we conduct asylum.
Since February, over 2,000 people that were blocked by the deactivated program have been able to enter the United States, according to official data provided by the International Organization for Migration. Meanwhile, the number of irregular crossings is increasing at the southern border. In February 2021, the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Border Patrol reported nearly 100,000 apprehensions, many of them unaccompanied minors.
Numbers that I'm seeing right now are higher than we saw under 2019, higher than we saw in any other year. So I worry about those numbers because that leads me to believe that we are going to hit a crisis, especially under COVID-19.
Until now, the Biden administration has kept Title 42 active, an emergency measure imposed a year ago due to the pandemic, which prevents entry into the United States. But in Laredo, Texas, which is in the district that Congressman Cuellar represents, residents are alarmed by the influx.
In our area, they caught 10,000 people in 7 days, 2,500 in just 2 days. So the numbers are increasing. And what concerns people is Border Patrol checking those folks for COVID-19?
White House officials insist the border is closed to reduce the number of migrants risking their lives on a dangerous journey to the north, especially children. The Biden administration is also restarting a program to reunite minors with family members in the U.S. that was terminated by former President Trump.
Now allow those people to actually have a legal way to arrive in the United States through the Central American Minors Program. And after this first phase of reviewing all of the previous applications, we'll be opening a second phase in the summer where we'll take new applications so that people have what the administration is focused on, a safe, secure, legal, and organized way and a humane way to arrive in the United States.
All these changes are a noticeable shift from the immigration policies of the previous Trump administration. Celia Mendoza, VOA News, El Paso, Texas.
Former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig stood trial in a Beijing courthouse Monday on spying charges. That hearing took place more than 2 years after he and fellow Canadian Michael Spavor were arrested. Reuters' Jason Albano takes it from here.
Come and get that up.
The trial of another Canadian citizen charged with espionage began Monday in a Beijing courthouse. Former diplomat Michael Kovrig is the second of two Canadians tried for spying in China this month, following the trial of businessman Michael Spavor on Friday. Both were arrested over 2 years ago. The trial comes just days after the United States raised concerns over their case at tense bilateral talks with China in Alaska. Both trials were held behind closed doors for what Beijing said were national security reasons. Jim Nickel, the deputy head of the Canadian embassy in Beijing, was present outside the courthouse. He said he had been repeatedly denied access to the hearing.
He's been arbitrarily detained, and now we see that the court process itself is not transparent. We're very troubled by this. We have with us today some 28 representatives of the embassies here in Beijing. They're representing 26 different countries in support, showing the solidarity and support and lending their voice to for the immediate release of Michael Kovrig.
Dubbed the two Michaels in the Canadian press, the pair were arrested soon after Canadian officials detained telecoms giant Huawei's CFO Mengwan Zhou on a U.S. warrant. Beijing has said that the incidents are not linked. Meng remains under house arrest in Vancouver as she fights extradition to the United States. While the country's courts have yet to reach a verdict in either trial, the country has a conviction rate of over 99%.
Jason Albano from Reuters News. The European Union, Britain, Canada, and the United States have launched coordinated sanctions against Chinese officials over human rights abuses in China's far western Xinjiang region. The move sparked a quick reaction from Beijing, which targeted EU officials, including lawmakers and academics, in return. The sanctions include travel bans and asset freezes. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that, quote, "A united transatlantic response sends a strong signal," end quote. The United States on Monday also announced sanctions against two more individuals and two entities linked to Myanmar's military. In a press release from the Treasury Department, the U.S. says the sanctions are a result of the government's continued campaign of violence and intimidation against peaceful protesters and civil society. There was no immediate comment from the government in Myanmar, which is also known as Burma. It coincides with additional sanctions from the EU on Myanmar officials, and the AP's Charles de Ledesma has that part of the story.
The bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the EU is penalizing the officials accused of being involved in a military coup and the violent crackdown on protesters that followed.
We are going to take sanctions against 11 persons involved in the coup and on the repression of the demonstrators.
The military junta had prevented Myanmar's parliament from convening on February 1 and claimed that last November's elections, won by the pro-democracy party in a landslide, were tainted by fraud. In the face of persistent strikes and protests, the junta has responded with an increasingly violent crackdown and efforts to limit the information reaching the outside world. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In Myanmar, university students in the southern city of Dawe marched against the country's military government. Chanting "Our fight must prevail" and marching along the central city market, the students called for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi and other democratically elected leaders who have been detained by the military government since the February 1st coup. The UN Human Rights Office said on Monday that at least 224 civilians have been confirmed killed at the hands of security forces, including while in custody. And the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners said that more than 2,000 people have been detained since the coup began. It's week three for jury selection in the trial of a former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer charged in the death of George Floyd. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has more.
13 jurors have been seated for Derek Chauvin's trial on murder and manslaughter charges. The judge has said two more will be seated ahead of opening statements expected March 29th. Only 12 will deliberate. The others will be alternates, needed only if some jurors are unable to serve for any reason. On Friday, Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill declined a defense request to delay or move Chauvin's trial over concerns that a $27 million settlement for Floyd's family had tainted the jury pool. I'm Shelley Adler.
Police say multiple people were killed in a shooting at a Colorado supermarket, including a police officer. Boulder Police Commander Kerry Yamaguchi said at the news conference Monday that a person of interest is in custody and being treated. He did not give any additional details on how many people were killed or other details about the shooting. He said they were still investigating and didn't have details on a motive. Saudi Arabia has offered a ceasefire proposal to Yemen's Houthi rebels that includes reopening their country's main airport. The offer is part of the kingdom's latest attempt to halt years of fighting in a war that has sparked the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The move comes after the rebels stepped up drone and missile attacks on the kingdom's oil sites, briefly shaking global energy prices. Farhan Haq, the deputy spokesperson for the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, welcomed the announcement.
We also welcome Saudi support for UN efforts. Special Envoy Martin Griffiths has been working to secure a nationwide ceasefire, the reopening of Sana'a Airport to civilian air traffic, allowing additional fuel and commodities to enter Hodeidah port, and resuming a political process to end the conflict. There is no doubt that every effort must be made to end the conflict in Yemen and address the suffering of the Yemeni people. And the United Nations looks forward to continuing its work with the parties to achieve this goal.
The proposed plan would see taxes, customs, and other fees generated by Yemen's Hodeidah Airport put into a joint account for Yemen's central bank. The account would then be accessible to the rebels and Yemen's recognized government. But a senior Houthi official told the Associated Press that the Saudis need to do more to secure a ceasefire. A North Korean citizen was taken into U.S. custody on Saturday after being extradited from Malaysia to face money laundering charges, making him the first North Korean extradited to the United States to face trial. His extradition came after a Malaysian court rejected his assertion that the charges were politically motivated. Moon Jae-myung has denied the allegations, and North Korea has said it has terminated diplomatic ties with Malaysia over the decision to extradite Moon to the U.S. More than 130 people have been killed in a shooting attack in the African country of Niger. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The government of Niger says it was gunmen on motorcycles that launched the attacks on a series of villages near the border with Mali. Officials are calling this the deadliest violence to strike the African country in recent memory. Scores of victims have been gunned down. Violent attacks have been on the rise in the weeks following the election of Niger's new president, Mohamed Bazoum. Niger, Mali, and neighboring Burkina Faso are battling the spread of deadly extremist violence, which includes the Islamic State Group, and Al-Qaeda. I'm Jackie Quinn.
UN human rights experts say conditions are deteriorating for millions of civilians caught up in the chronic armed conflict in the northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The experts presented their latest findings to the UN Human Rights Council on Monday. Lisa Schlein reports.
The last time UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet testified about conditions in Congo's eastern Kasai region was October. At that time, she presented evidence of the devastating impact of armed conflict on the people, noting that some incidents could amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity. She told the council Monday that since then, the situation in the eastern DRC, especially in the provinces of North and South Kivu and Ituri, has continued to worsen. She called the scale of violence alarming. She said that last year, her office had verified the killing of nearly 3,000 civilians by armed groups. She said hateful rhetoric from politicians, community leaders, and members of the Congolese diaspora is making the situation worse.
Given the context of escalating bloodshed and the country's history of intercommunal violence, I am deeply concerned that the current widespread increase in hate speech could further inflame conflict. Widespread impunity for violations and abuses of human rights, mistrust between communities, and discrimination against certain groups contribute to this terrain.
Bachelet called on Congolese authorities to strengthen efforts to combat discrimination and hostility against people because of their ethnic, religious, and gender identity. Bantu Keita is head of MONUSCO, the UN stabilization mission in the DRC. She has just returned from a visit to Goma, Bukavu, Beni, and Bunia, where she met with military and civil authorities. Keita said she discussed her concerns about the rampant violence, escalating armed attacks, and worsening human rights situation in the eastern provinces. She spoke through an interpreter.
It is urgent to redouble efforts in order to bring security to the populations, to attack the different causes underlying conflicts, and guaranteed stability in the east. all of this in the strict respect of international humanitarian law and human rights.
The DRC's Minister for Human Rights, André Lite Asebeya, told the Council Monday that his government is working to promote and protect human rights. He said his country had problems with terrorist groups in the East and that it was exploring all avenues to eradicate this scourge. He said efforts were underway to reform the security service as well as legal procedures regarding international crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
Grieving the death of a loved one can be one of the most painful life events. Grief can affect a person's physical, mental, and emotional health. Sleep disruptions are said to be among the effects of grieving. A new study by American and Dutch researchers suggests that people who had sleep problems prior to a loved one's death may have more difficulty with the grieving process and is at risk of developing something called complicated grief. According to the Mayo Clinic, those with complicated grief have feelings of loss that are devastating and don't improve even after a long time. With complicated grief, painful emotions are so severe and last so long that the individual has trouble recovering and resuming their lives. Experts say 7 to 20% of bereaved people will suffer from complicated grief. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. AstraZeneca said on Monday that the results of its COVID-19 vaccine trials provide evidence that its shot provides, quote, 100% efficacy against severe or critical disease and hospitalization, end quote. In an interview with the AP, AstraZeneca Biopharmaceuticals Research Chief Mene Pangalos said this study should make it clear the vaccine works and is safe.
I do hope it puts to bed any doubts about the vaccine efficacy, because I think this is a highly effective vaccine that's easy to use, easy to distribute around the world, and has an important role to play in curtailing the pandemic around the world.
U.S. trials also show that the AstraZeneca COVID shot is safe and 79% effective against preventing symptomatic coronavirus cases. That's according to Britain's University of Oxford, the developers of the pharmaceutical company's vaccine. Several European countries have recently stopped using the AstraZeneca vaccine because of reports that it was associated with blood clots in recipients. The European Medicines Agency said last week that the vaccine is safe and does not raise an overall risk of blood clots. According to the Associated Press, the AstraZeneca vaccine has been authorized for use in more than 50 countries. The Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center has reported that more than 123.2 million worldwide coronavirus infections have occurred, as well as 2.7 million deaths. Scientists are still learning how the coronavirus affects the body and why it's so lethal. A Cleveland Clinic survey indicates more than half of those questioned didn't know COVID-19 could affect their hearts, and nearly 70% didn't know that high blood pressure also increases the risk if they get the virus. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
One thing cardiologists know by now, people with heart problems have a higher risk for serious complications if they get COVID-19. Yet many people are unaware of this. Dr. Samir Kapadia is chair of cardiovascular medicine at Cleveland Clinic.
Many people know that it affects the lungs, but it can also affect the heart, the pumping function of the heart, the clotting mechanisms in the blood. All of this put you to a very high risk of having cardiovascular problems.
COVID can also damage healthy hearts, even if people don't show any symptoms. Dr. Alan Anderson is the chief of cardiology at the University of Texas Health Science Center.
We see patients who have likely had viral infections that they didn't even recognize, and yet they manifest with heart failure symptoms months or years later. So there could be a long-term implication to the health of patients who have been affected by COVID-19.
Dr. Anderson says this is true even for some patients who had healthy hearts before getting the coronavirus.
They had elevations of blood enzyme markers that were consistent with a heart attack, even though they didn't have any blockages in their coronary arteries. They had heart rhythm disturbances, and that this occurred with quite high prevalence.
Emotional stress also plays a role, says Dr. Kapadia.
People who have fear, people who have anger, it has been shown that both of these can lead to blood clotting mechanisms and can cause heart attacks.
Some of the heart damage doctors are seeing is reversible, but some is not, and it can lead to death. At the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, researchers are testing an antibiotic and a medication for diabetes. They want to see if these drugs can prevent heart damage in COVID patients. Antibiotics fight bacterial infections. They don't work on viruses. But there are tiny, bean-shaped parts inside our cells called mitochondria. Mitochondria generate chemical energy and drive many of our body's functions, including our heartbeat. Scientists believe that mitochondria evolved from a type of bacteria, so an antibiotic might protect them from the coronavirus, and the mitochondria, in turn, would protect the heart. The diabetes drug being tested also helps mitochondria continue to produce energy. The researchers hope to start clinical trials with people who have recovered from the coronavirus so doctors can see if the volunteers' hearts continue to function well long after they have recovered from COVID-19. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Many experts say that the world should be preparing for another pandemic, not if, but when it hits. One man who has thought deeply on this subject is Thomas J. Boyke. He's the Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and the co-director of its Independent Task Force on Preparing for the Next Pandemic. He began his conversation with VOA's Adam Phillips by praising the stellar role that science has played in dealing with the current crisis.
One part of the global response to this pandemic that went well was the science.
I remember the genetic sequence of the virus was published by China within 5 days.
And we were already had identified vaccine candidates, and within 66 days, they were already into clinical trials. And we developed the first effective vaccine against this virus within 10 months. The previous record had been 4 years. But despite how quickly we developed that vaccine and how quickly we ramped up production, we still suffered $20 trillion in economic losses and more than 3 million deaths globally.
How can we avoid those sorts of catastrophic numbers in the future?
Part of that is health systems that can protect people and also contain this virus better and be able to identify its emergence. And part of it is accelerating effective vaccines and treatments even more than what we saw in this crisis.
What other improved strategies can you recommend moving forward?
The first is around surveillance. We can no longer depend on the reporting and transparency of the directly affected country to learn about an outbreak. In every major epidemic we have seen, the directly affected country was late in reporting. So we recommend a hospital-based sentinel surveillance network, voluntary, anonymous data that at least can keep track week in and week out. That would have made a difference in this case, where at a minimum, the virus started to emerge in early December and nobody knew about it globally until the beginning of January. And about that point, it had spread. So we need to be able to identify outbreaks earlier. The second thing is that we've seen very little progress on global cooperation on addressing this pandemic. There should be, for interested governments, an opportunity to work together on all the non-health aspects of a pandemic. So sharing medicines, making sure we're not taking trade measures that make it harder to get supplies of masks and other personal protective equipment out of countries, having more coordination on economic relief. all the things that happen in a pandemic that aren't just about health.
What's the third element your task force recommends when contemplating a future pandemic?
We need a architecture to support R&D so that we can develop vaccines and therapeutics, diagnostics even faster, but also get them on a more equitable basis to the world sooner. People refer to this as a once in a 100-year pandemic, but the next pandemic threat could be emerging next year, next month, even today. New viruses emerge all the time, and we have to be better prepared than we were in this crisis.
There are many subtle but powerfully integrated elements to consider when trying to prevent or mitigating a future pandemic. An environmental approach is certainly one.
Moving forward, we really do need to take what they refer to as a one world health approach to preparing and responding to pandemics. We can't just focus on what can keep our country safe once a pandemic emerges elsewhere. We have to restrain the practices, whether they be agricultural or development, that contribute to the emergence of these new viruses to begin with. And one really good example of that is, of course, bushmeat, wildlife markets. Really need to think more holistically about where the threats might come from in the future, and some of that may be on the treatment of wildlife.
Thomas J. Boyke is the co-director of the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force on Preparing for the Next Pandemic. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. Analysts say the world's dependence on gasoline isn't likely to return to pre-pandemic levels. That's partly because of moves toward increases in fuel efficiency and an accelerating global shift to use alternative green energy sources. Despite the Biden administration's talk of recalibrating its relationship with Saudi Arabia over human rights concerns, analysts say Washington's ties to the oil giant remain vital. Dale Gavlak brings us this story.
The International Energy Agency, a Paris-based intergovernmental watchdog, says that while oil demand may continue to rise as developing countries with growing populations use more of it, such demand will be offset globally by an accelerating use of greener energy sources. Swiss energy analyst Cornelia Meyer says oil demand overall fell by close to 10% in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic. The world's largest oil company, Saudi Aramco, saw its profits nearly halved last year to $49 billion as the pandemic roiled global energy markets. But oil prices are edging up again as movement restrictions ease, commerce increases, and more people get vaccinated against COVID-19. President Biden, meanwhile, has waived punishment for Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the 2018 killing of U.S.-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, saying this would have been diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. This despite the unease it causes to U.S. strategic interests and values, says Princeton University Gulf scholar Bernard Heichel.
Saudi Arabia is an extremely important country for U.S. strategic interests. And it's not just about oil. It's also about the stability of the region. It has to do with global financial markets and their stability and the reserve currency, the dollar, that being the principal currency in which oil is traded. So it's a very complicated relationship. The Biden administration cannot push purely human rights agenda when it comes to Saudi Arabia.
The U.S. also runs 5 military bases in Saudi Arabia and is eyeing expanding its operations there amid heightened tensions with Iran, which Yasmin Farouk, a visiting fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says is vital for Washington.
Saudi Arabia is crucial to the priority access in the Middle East to the U.S. military. Anyone in the military would tell you this. In terms of land, sea, air, it is one of the world's biggest economies. They have a global outreach because of their Islamic power and their investments. They have the biggest media empire in the Middle East. They reach the rest of the Islamic world. They can shape public opinions.
Farouk says that Saudi Arabia is also the world's biggest arms buyer. Stephen Cook of the Council on Foreign Relations told Britain's The Guardian newspaper that if Washington is going to get the Saudis out of Yemen, the U.S. is going to need the Saudis' cooperation. And he said Washington will need to work with Riyadh on the Iran nuclear deal. In Cook's words, Saudi Arabia is a big, important country that's just super hard to avoid. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.